Wow, that's a good question. I have a vague memory of, and this is not exciting at all, but a brown leather sofa we used to have in our house. Okay. I remember standing next to it and it being like the same height as me. So I probably would have been 3 or 4, but my memory isn't even the best of times. So that could be completely, I could have dreamt that, you know?
Yeah.
Certainly I can't remember anything more exciting, you know? I always find I remember smells, you know, more than anything else. Like, and that's something funny. That's something people always talk about when it's whiskey and coffee is, you know, whenever you smell something, they can immediately take you back to a specific memory.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, like whenever I smell, you know, new plastic, like, you know, it just, you've just opened up a container of like, I don't know, a toy or something. And it immediately takes me back to being a kid and going to Florida.
Wow.
Because the smell of pool toys, you know, that like plasticky smell.
Yeah.
But people always say that with like whiskey as well. They'll be like, oh, this really reminds me of, you know, my granddad or like an old sofa or an old room I had in my house.
Awesome, mate. I know the two are interconnected, but like, would you say you're a better smeller or a better taster?
Well, I mean, it really is your sense of smell is the most important thing. You can only really taste, you know, 4 or 5 things: sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. It's your nose, your olfactory sense, which is really picking up most flavor. So there's about 400 or so different things you can smell. So, I mean, that's why people always say, you know, if you lose your sense of smell, your sense of taste, you pretty much lose that as well. But yeah, I definitely, yeah, it's all about the aroma, really.
Wow. That's awesome. You've set me up for a good alley-oop here. One of the things that I was thinking about doing in this conversation was, I think about these episodes sometimes as like little hour-long autobiographies, because usually my kind of style is, it's a bit of a hero's journey. It's like, start off when you're young, what were you interested in school, blah, 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 and kind of take someone all the way through, like an overview of the life. And I was thinking like, well, what could we do for this episode? And I had this idea of, instead of like an autobiography, what if we did like a scrapbook of different like smells and tastes at different points throughout your life?
Wow. Okay.
And you just already did the first one. And I'm like, oh, mate, this is great. We're on an absolute roll. So if you were then to take us just a little bit further, let's say, and these are rough ages, let's say like around the ages of like 5 or 7, what are some of the key kind of like tastes or smells? And I understand this is a ridiculously weird question, so like, please take some time to think about it.
So, I mean, 5 to 7, I think that would have been that plasticky pool smell. Like,
yeah.
So it smells like that new plastic, smells like chlorine, you know, because that would be what you smell when you go on holiday, which is obviously the most fun time of the year.
Sure.
So that would be definitely then, you know, and the smell of toys as well, like plastic toys.
Take us to 10, 12-ish sort of then.
10, 12. I always remember the smell of cardboard from books, you know, whenever you were in school. Like, I mean, literally the paperback books that you used to write in always used to have that kind of papery, cardboardy sort of smell to them. And then mixed with the smell of the pencil, of the lead as well, was always something that stuck with me. So yeah, we've gone from really fun childhood memories to school.
But that's just the story of your life. You have a blast until you're 5, and then you go to school, and then you have mixed experiences. How did you enjoy school, or what was your experience of primary school like?
I had a great time in primary school. I went to Holy Rosary, and like, I'm still really close with a lot of the people I went to school with.
Unbelievable.
Like, yeah, like one of my closest friends, Niall, like he was in nursery school with him, primary school, then secondary school. I had a close group of friends. You know, I lived kind of around the Ormer Road anyway, so school was close to me. So yeah, I had a good time at school, you know. Definitely primary school. I think secondary school was probably a bit more patchy, but like that's the same for everybody.
That's,
I think,
the human experience, isn't it?
Yeah.
At that early age, like, what sort of stuff were you really interested in? Anything that kind of stands out, or were you just a bit, I just enjoy my life here?
Like kind of 10, 12, around there?
Yeah.
I mean, probably it's just the typical stuff. Like, I liked, really got into video games, you know, like it's probably the same as every, you know, boy my that age.
Awesome,
like, got
bro.
Really into video games.
What was your console?
I had, do you know what, actually, the first console we had, and this is going to make me sound older than I am, was a SNES. It was a Super Nintendo,
yeah,
but it was my brother's. So I remember playing games like Mario on it and really falling in love with it. And then I think the first console I had myself was an N64.
Nice.
Which I would love to go back and replay, like. But funny enough, I was looking on Gumtree the other day for something, and there was, you know, the old CRT TVs, the big boxy ones.
Yeah,
one of those came up, and I was like, how cool would it be to buy one of those and just hook out an N64 or a SNES and relive my youth.
Honestly, though, like the curved screens and all, like they make me think of, like, you know, the huge computers I feel like every school used to have back in the day. And they were CRT. Just like, they're like antiques now. Like the things you could do with them, I'd even just love one as like an ornament, which is probably a bit ridiculous.
But they all still work is the funny thing. Like I had a contractor in my house yesterday replacing a washing machine, and it's a rented house, and he was like, do you know what? I've been repairing this washing machine for like 30 years. he said that was the sixth time he'd come back to repair it.
Oh my god!
And I was like, wow, I can't imagine anything new lasting that long now, 30 years.
Yeah. It's really crazy. Like my granny always goes on about how, you know, things don't last the way they used to. She has this little tool for the garden that like does the edges. I can't even describe it. It's like a stick that has like a spinny cutty thing on it, and you can wheel it around the edge of your grass, and it kind of does the edges perfectly. And she bought me one. She literally was like, yeah, I bought you this one, it's the only one I could find, but I think the one I have will literally still last longer than this brand
new
one.
The one she has probably weighs like four times as much.
Yeah.
It's funny, our cooper, the guy that actually would manage our barrels, you know, that we use to mature our whiskey, he's using his great-grandfather's tools still. Like there's tools like, and now he's got one called like the crows, he's got, you know, they're all named after animals, like the dog. Mm. And he's a like fifth generation cooper, I think. So he all the way back in his family. But yeah, I remember being in the cooperage, and he was showing me, and he was like, "Yeah, it still works perfectly well."
Wow.
You know, and because it's such a small, like such a niche job, there's nobody making these tools. So he's like, "Yeah, I have to keep using this."
Bro, that's crazy.
I know, blew my mind,
mate. Imagine if you like need to replace your crew. All of a sudden, you're like, "I have no place to get this."
Yeah, I'm gonna have to make it myself. Or
mate. Crazy. Yeah. So then Patchy High School, like the rest of us, speak a little bit to that.
Yeah, I mean, I was probably like kind of geeky, quieter kid in you know, secondary school. Still had a close group of friends I was really into. I suppose that's the kind of age where you start discovering yourself and finding things that you really like. So kind of got into music. Still played a lot of video games.
Awesome.
But yeah, you know, I think probably like if we're talking kind of around 16 or maybe around that age, then that was when I was at that unfortunate position where you're like, I have to figure out what I'm going to do, you know. I couldn't do it. Like I couldn't decide. Everybody else had kind of chosen what they're going to do. So
everyone else is a liar.
Yeah, they're probably just spoofing it. Sure.
Yeah.
We're all doing different things now anyway. Mm-hmm. Like that's a thing. But yeah, I got into photography randomly. Like, because I was into TV and films, you know, loved movies, still do. But yeah, kind of got into photography a bit. And then that was the sort of direction I started going in for a few years.
Nice.
So like that would have been, I then would have left school. I did stay on and did like sixth year and upper sixth, got my A-levels, and then went and did like film and TV in tech in Millfield. And then did photography after that. And then suddenly ended up in a completely different place as normally is the way.
Yeah. And so then around that like 16 to 18 sort of last few years of high school, give us a smell or give us a taste.
Probably not the most appropriate thing, but probably like the first time you taste whiskey or beer or something, you know. Being outside a lot, I suppose, you know, like we used to hang out outside, you know, because you're 16, you're at that age where you're too young to go to the bar.
Yeah.
But you're also like, you don't want to be sitting in your parents' house. So we used to just go out and walk places. So I remember like always smell of like just dirt and trees. And, you know, we used to hang out in like old forests, places that were abandoned, you know, you just wander about the place. Sometimes like, yeah, you'd probably do something stupid, like light a wee small fire so you'd get the smell of the smoke and the wood.
Sure, yeah.
But yeah, mostly probably just being outside.
Cool, man. And when did you kind of, I'm sure you get this question all the time, it's probably like in your cliche sort of Rolodex, like when did you get into whiskey? Because there's a big difference between drinking whiskey occasionally and enjoying it, or even drinking whiskey every day and enjoying it, and then really becoming passionate about whiskey the way you have.
Well, I actually, the whole reason I got into the, you know, the drinks trade in the first place was when I was 15. My brother, who he worked in the vineyard on the Omer Road.
Oh, sweet.
And I just remember him waking me up one day at like, must be 9 o'clock or something. He was like, you're coming to work. Like, you're going to work with me today. And I was like, right, okay. So I ended up working in the vineyard. Like I was 15, so I wasn't able to serve anybody or do anything like that. I was mostly just sweeping up the floor and stacking shelves and stuff. But, you know, as I got a bit older, I started to get interest in some of the stuff that was around me, and being exposed to like all these great wines, great beers and great spirits. It was actually beer was what I was really into at the start. I was really into craft beer. probably when I was around like 18, 19. And actually did like a bit of home brewing and stuff. And then I was like, I'm going to start a brewery. I'm going to do this. And then I bought a book. It was like how to start a brewery. And the whole first half of the book was how difficult it was. And I was like, maybe this isn't a good idea.
Step one, get £1 million.
Yeah. It was like, here's all the loopholes and regulations that you're always going to be faced with. But looking now at the craft beer scene, I'm like, maybe that would have been a good idea. But yeah, so I was into beer, and then I got into wine. I got really into my wine, and like I thought, oh, this is something I'm going to go into. And you know, I did some wine qualifications. Like I did the guys at the vineyard were able to put me through the WSET and learn a wee bit about wine. And then yeah, I just kind of gradually started to get an interest in spirits in general. And I actually drank bourbon. I think you know what it was. It was probably watching like Mad Men.
Yeah, you're like, everyone wants to be Don Draper. Yeah,
so I'm drinking an Old Fashioned. I was like, I want to look that cool. So I got into bourbon and I was making Old Fashions, probably really bad. Old Fashions probably weren't very good. And then gradually kind of started removing the ingredients and just sipping it straight. And I was like, oh, I actually quite like this.
Mm.
And then, funny enough, the sales rep for the company that I work for now left a bottle of Pars, Three Swallow, not one of the ones we have today, but another one in, and I tasted it and I was like, oh, this is actually really nice. And then over the next few years, started to get really into Irish whiskey. And, you know, I still enjoy, like, I've tried everything, like tried Japanese whiskey and Scotch whiskey, but Irish was just what I kind of landed on. And yeah, from probably the last, so I'm 30 now, it's probably the last kind of 7, 8 years I've been really interested in it, you know.
Wow.
And then obviously working in it now for the last 5 years.
Yeah. I think like, and this could be just like a misconception or like a false story I tell myself. I think one of the things, one of the barriers that holds me back from really getting into something like whiskey or any sort of like food and drink in a really big way is that I feel like I have a really, really basic sense of smell and a really basic sense of taste. Was there ever a moment where you kind of discovered or realized, compared to the average Joe, I'm actually quite good at tasting stuff?
Well, some people naturally are good at it, which is what I find. Some people have really good palates naturally. Generally, it's more often women. Women tend to be really quickly have good palates. For me, it's not something that I definitely wouldn't say it was like a natural thing to me. Like it was over the course of exposing yourself to it more and more.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the first times was when I went to the first time I'd ever been to a whiskey tasting. It was in what was the Hudson Bar.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a wee whiskey club upstairs and they would meet, I think, like once a month. And I went to a Japanese whiskey tasting there. I think it was a Japanese whiskey tasting. And it was when I started to hear other people talking about it. And, you know, maybe it's the power of suggestive thinking or suggestive, you know, as soon as somebody says it, you're like, oh, yeah, I actually see a bit of that.
I do taste licorice.
I mean, there is a bit of truth to that. But suddenly seeing this and I was like, this is actually really interesting and really cool. And yeah, like from that point, I suppose, just like what we used to do with my friends was we'd, you know, instead of just buying one bottle of whiskey,
mm-hmm.
somebody would take something probably stolen from their parents or something. And like we would, you know, on a Friday night, we would sit down and we would taste everything kind of side by side. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the ways I started to discover like, oh, these whiskeys actually all taste really different, mm-hmm. you know, because I think if you're tasting it once and then next week you taste something different and the following week you taste something else, you know, it can be hard to see the subtle differences between them, but mm-hmm. having them side by side, which is one of the reasons whiskey tastings are such a powerful way to, you know, discover flavor, is you realize very quickly that these are completely different spirits, completely different taste profiles.
Yeah. What did you do like between the ages of 20 and 25?
That was when I would have been at tech. So I was a tech doing film and I would have been tech and then I would have been at uni. So I did photography at uni. And I was also working in the vineyard at the same time.
Nice.
So that would have been, around the time that I'd been kind of starting to think, should I continue working here and working in drinks and spirits, or should I go into photography? And I did work like as a photographer for a bit. You know, I was doing wee small freelance jobs and it was a bit of fun. But I'm sure anybody who works professionally as a photographer would tell you that like it's a challenging field to work in.
Brutal.
You know,
yeah,
everybody's got a smartphone now. Everybody wants to be a photographer. So yeah, I kind of moved away from that. I was still doing a couple of wee odd bits and pieces. And then it would have been when I think I was 25 when I actually got this job. Mm. So that's, yeah, it would have been 5 years in May that I have actually been with the company. So
what was that like? Because, I mean, you know, again, you're at that age where you kind of just spat out of the education system. you're doing your work, you're figuring out, right, what's my next big play here? I imagine you didn't, like, did you know that jobs like this existed?
No, definitely not. What had happened was I was working, I was in the vineyard one day, and I can remember this really well. I was chatting to John, who's one of the sales guys for the company that still works for Dylan Bass. We were talking about age statements on whiskey. And then I was talking a little bit about whiskey blend. And I was like, oh, it's not all about the age. And then he'd said, well, do you know we're actually recruiting for a Powers ambassador? And I think, yeah, at that stage, I didn't even know the word ambassador. Like, you know, unless you worked for the UN or something. I was like, what does that mean? But I looked it up and I was like, yeah, I could apply for this. And applied for it and, you know, got an interview. Wow. Went down to the offices and I remember it was the first interview of the day, and it was 8:30 in the morning, I think, my interview was at. And the interview was, I had to host a whiskey tasting. So it was like probably the earliest whiskey tasting anyone's ever done.
Yeah, you should have some sort of world record for that.
Yeah, don't worry. We were actually just more talking about the whiskey and nosing them, but I got a laugh out of that. So I had to do a tasting of a couple of whiskeys, and they threw a bit of a curveball at me. They put a whiskey in there that I wasn't expecting, that wasn't one of their portfolio.
Dun, dun, dun.
But yeah, the interview obviously went well because I went back and pretty sure I had a second interview then, I think. But yeah, then I got a phone call. I was actually in work one day. I was in the vineyard again. I got a phone call saying, yeah, I would like to offer you the job. Wow. So I was like, wow, really delighted and was surprised, you know, because I think there was probably a lot of people went for it. But yeah, that was kind of how I started working for the brand. And that was my first official whiskey job.
Brilliant, man. Unbelievable. So, I mean, like, the immediate question that my granny would ask you is, like, what do you actually do? Like, what does your day-to-day look like?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. Like, my parents, I think I've explained to them so many times what my job is. And and when people ask them, they're like, oh, so what's Joe doing? They're like, it's something to do with whiskey.
I feel your pain. All my family's like, yeah, he just talks to people for a living.
but he makes money off that. Like, I mean, it's essentially being the face of the brand is the big part. So while we're here to talk about Powers, I actually am quite fortunate that I'm the ambassador for all of our, what we call our prestige brands. So I would do work for, you know, the likes of Redbreast Whiskey, The Spots, Method Madness, the Middleton range.
Just explain that hierarchy a little bit, because it's still something that I'm trying to figure out. So what is the umbrella that holds all these brands together?
So I work for Dylan Bass, gotcha. Which is the easiest way to explain is it's kind of like the northern section of Irish distillers, Pernod Ricard. Mm-hmm. And Irish distillers are the biggest producer and, you know, brand owner for Irish whiskey. So their distillery is in Middleton. So Middleton is a small enough town, I think it's population like 25,000. And it's about 10 minutes from Cork, 10 minutes out of Cork City. Then that's where we make our whiskey. A lot of these brands like Powers and Jameson, you know, because there's references to Dublin, people think that they're still made in Dublin. But what happened was in the 60s, Irish whiskey was in a really rough position, like very close to disappearing altogether. You know, there was only four distilleries still operating on the island at one stage. So in the 1960s, what happened was competitors, which would have been John Parr and Son, John Jameson and Son, and CDC, Cork Distilleries Company, which would have been Paddy Whiskey, decided to actually merge together.
Epic.
So that was really kind of, they just thought we could either destroy ourselves, you know, by competing, or we can join up. So I think just chatting to our archivist, Carol, she was like, yeah, the negotiations for that merger were intense, because these guys have been competitors for decades.
But it's amazing that they would even have the thought to come together, but I guess needs must.
Yeah, well, I mean, the truth is, like, if they didn't do that, it is very likely that Irish whiskey wouldn't exist the way we know it now.
Wow.
You know, it was at one point the biggest spirit in the world, and there were distilleries all over Ireland, but there were a lot of big blows. Like, so you know, the partition of Ireland, trade wars with Britain. The biggest blow really was Prohibition in America.
Mm.
So America is and was the biggest market for Irish whiskey. So whenever they suddenly said, we're not going to buy any, we're not going to make it legal to buy alcohol, that caused big issues for us. So that was our biggest kind of biggest market. And
I guess it forced people to make their own, and that probably birthed their own industry, was it?
Well, funny enough, what happened was two things. First of all, our competitors in Scotland, what they started to do was flood all the territories around, like Canada, etc. So all the Scotch whiskey was making it into Canada and then eventually getting to the United States. But at the time, Irish whiskey was considered a better product. And I'm not hating on Scotch whiskey because I love Scottish whiskey. But at the time, Irish whiskey was better. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you could sell it for a higher price. So what happened was bootleggers started to make counterfeit Irish whiskey. So they made this hooch, you know, they used to call it. And like the stuff was gut rot. Like they used to run it through car radiators to color it to make it brown. So it was so bad that if it didn't either kill you or make you very sick, you certainly weren't going to drink it again. So that was a big blow to Irish whiskey as a brand. You know, people suddenly said Irish whiskey doesn't taste good. I'm going to drink Scotch, and it's taken decades to recover. It's still not, you know, that's why Scottish whiskey is still so big.
Wow.
But fortunately, things are definitely on the up. Like Irish whiskey right now is in a really good place, and it seems to be going in the right direction.
It's cool. So when you say like that Irish whiskey at that time was better, what does that actually mean?
I mean, it certainly would have been seen as more premium. And I think a lot of the guys who had been making whiskey in Ireland knew very well what they were doing. Like we were making a style of whiskey called pot still, mm-hmm. which is still, you know, a big style of whiskey for us. Like 70% of what's in that bottle of Powers is pot still whiskey. And globally, there was a demand for this taste. So pot still is, you know, characterized by being quite rich, mm-hmm. quite creamy, quite spicy. And certainly back then, that was what the global demand was for. Like people wanted that bigger style of whiskey, which is interesting because it's kind of gone in the opposite direction. You know, sort of around the 1950s, 1960s, the global demand was changing to lighter blended styles.
Yeah.
But at that time, certainly people wanted that kind of richer, more full-bodied style of whiskey. And you'll see quotes from people, like even like Shakespeare, you know, talking about how he has a preference for Irish whiskey. But yeah.
Excellent marketing.
Yeah.
Thanks to the big man.
We don't have ambassadors like that anymore, you know. I think I do an okay job, but I'm no Shakespeare.
Yeah. Well, you know, who knows? See what way things go. So at the age of 25, you get this job. Give us like an important taste or smell from that period of your life.
Whiskey. Like honestly, it was suddenly being exposed to so much more. So I'd been lucky enough to try lots of different whiskies, you know, just from working over the years. But suddenly I was part of a company that had, you know, dozens of different brands and dozens of Irish whiskies. And it wasn't even just whiskey I was tasting. Suddenly I was exposed to gin, which is something I previously hadn't had much of an interest in. But, you know, we have a lot of gins in our portfolio, so I was tasting those. But I suppose being able to taste like some stuff that I never would have got a chance to try before, you know, like we would have some very rare, some very old whiskies. And because I was starting to mix with a crowd of people who were really into the deep end of love and whiskey, they suddenly were, you know, sharing samples with me, and nice. I was attending more events. And, you know, over the years, like those relationships have kept going. So being able to try some very unusual, some older whiskies, you know, I was certainly exposed to like whiskies that were 25, 30 plus years old.
Yeah.
And as well as that, trying things that were bottled, you know, decades ago. So, you know, there are still bottles of old Powers and, you know, old Redbreast, etc. And suddenly having a chance to taste those, taste something that was distilled in Dublin, you know, 50, 60 years ago.
Wow. And this interview is probably best categorized as like a series of ignorant questions that I ask, although that's probably the whole show. What is whiskey and how is it made?
Yeah, it's actually a really good question because we do, like, one of the things I do is a whiskey walk. So we do like a whiskey tour in town, and that's the first thing I start is to ask people, like, do you know what whiskey is? And for a lot of people, they don't know how to actually define it, but it's pretty straightforward. So it's a distilled spirit made of cereal. So that's what it has to be made of. It has to be made out of cereal. So the most common one for us and for the Scotch is barley. So barley would be most commonly used, but you can also use maize, and you can use, you know, wheat or rye, but it always has to be cereal. The cereal is ground up, soaked in water, and fermented into a beer. So a type of beer, we call it wash at our distillery. Our wash is being, kind of being 10 and 12% ABV. That beer is then distilled into a spirit. So it would look exactly like a glass of water. Mm-hmm. It's completely clear, completely colourless.
I think that's the thing that freaked me out the most whenever I did a distillery tour, was they, you know, I was in a room and they were like, and look to your right through this transparent pipe and you can see this completely clear liquid, that's the whiskey. I was like, wait, what?
The word whiskey itself actually comes from the Irish ishkiba, which is water of life.
Wow.
So like it looks completely clear, completely colourless, it looks like water, does not taste like water. It's a lot more intense. And like, oh, I wish I'd brought some with me, but it's our pot still, our new make pot still spirit comes off at about 84%, 84.4%. So it's strong. And I always love to give people a taste and let people like just put a drop of it in their fingers. And 9 times out of 10, people are like, wow, that actually is really pleasant, you know, and really flavorsome. And like, I would not recommend anybody go home and drink a glass of it. But to taste, you know, the start of the whiskey making process is really interesting. And I think it's a great way. A lot of people say whiskey's all about the wood. And I think to say that is just an insult to the guys that make the spirit, because so much of the flavor comes from the spirit as well. It's about the spirit and about the wood. But we've got our spirit now, so we've distilled our wash. We've got a new make spirit now. And what we have to do is mature it in wood. So in Ireland and in Scotland, legally, it has to be matured for at least 3 years.
Wow.
So that's the minimum. Any younger than that, you can't call it whiskey. But after that 3 years, it's legally whiskey now, and you can bottle it and sell it and drink it.
Crazy. So, I mean, like, for these whiskey companies then, like, you're constantly acting a bit like a time traveler.
Yeah, I would say that if anybody wants to get into whiskey, you have to have a lot of patience. Like, when you talk about 3 years, it's not like I'm going to start a distillery and have a whiskey in 3 years. There's a lot of work that goes on behind that. You know, you've got to, build the distillery. You've got to source your cereal, which has to be grown.
Yeah.
You've got to source your barrels. Those trees have to be grown. So, like, nothing happens quickly. And I think our master blender, a guy called Billy Layton, he was saying to me that for forecasting some of our whiskeys, they plan, like, 40 to 50 years down the line.
Oh, my goodness.
Because, like, one of our whiskeys, you know, the oldest permanent expression of Redbreast is 27 years old. So he has to plan very, very far ahead just to make that whiskey. Even whiskeys like Powers and Jameson have to plan really well, because if demand keeps going, like, an Irish whiskey is the fastest growing premium spirits category, then in 5 years' time, we're going to need to have more than we currently have. So, yeah, we're kind of always in a state at Middleton of like, expanding and planning a lot down the line.
Something really weird happens whenever you put the whiskey inside the barrel. And I know you like talking about it. Talk to us about the Angel's Share.
The Angel's Share. So this is one that people always get a kick out of. So whenever you put whiskey into a barrel, or any spirit really, you will lose a bit of it through evaporation. So if you think of oak in particular, it's quite porous. So over time, some of it will escape into the atmosphere. And that's called the Angel's Share. So the angels always get their share, basically. And it's a really lovely term for what actually is a lot of whiskey that will never get drunk. And for us, for us in Middleton, we lose roughly 2% out of a barrel in a year, which doesn't really seem like much, you know, on paper. But if you think about a whiskey that's 5 years old, you know, that's 10% of that whiskey roughly that's gone. If you think about a whiskey that's 12 years old or 25 years old, that number adds up very, very quickly. For us, it works out at roughly, we lose about 35,000 bottles in a day.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So I don't know how long we've been talking now, but about every 2.5 seconds, that's a bottle of whiskey.
Oh, that's what keeps you up at night, is it?
Yeah. And if you ever go to Cork and you wonder why everybody's in a good mood, you know why. There's literally whiskey in the air.
But, unbelievable.
And that's for us. And like, if you think about what the climate's like in Ireland, and especially, you know, in Cork, like, it's not very hot. If you go to a hotter country, you can lose a lot more. So
that's,
you know,
one of the benefits of making it in Ireland, then, I guess.
That's one of the reasons Ireland and Scotland are so good at making whiskey, is because the weather's not great.
I never really thought of it like that before.
Yeah, so if you look at, like, bourbon, you know, where you're talking kind of Kentucky, Tennessee, much hotter, they're going to lose more.
Thirstier angels.
Thirstier angels, indeed, yeah. And if you go to the likes of the Caribbean, where they're making rum, like, I'd say they'd be losing a lot more than 2%.
Yeah. This could be just, like, complete semantics. You said, you know, a 5-year-old whiskey, and then you made the jump to 12, and then you said 25. If I was saying that, I would have went 5, 10, 20. Is there a reason why it's 12 years?
I mean, I'd said 12 because 12 is a pretty common age for.
Why is it common? Any reason?
That's a good question. I would say, you know, part of it, like, for us, the whiskey is ready when it's ready. We're not going to bottle it simply if it's 12 years old.
Yeah.
But I think for a lot of, you know, people buying whiskey, like, 12 is a number that exists in a lot of brands, you know, and this is me just speculating, like, you know, locally there'd be, like, 12-year-old whiskeys would be a lot of 12-year-old Scotch whiskey. So it's an age that, you know, would be fairly recognizable on a bottle.
This is just the way things are done, the regular kind?
In a sense, but also, like, the whiskey has to be the right flavor at 12 years old. You know, it's not like people are simply going to set out and say, I'm going to make a 12-year-old whiskey.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to make a good whiskey and bottle it when it's ready.
Yeah.
You know, and that would certainly be the case for us. And it's happened in the past where, like, we've tried, you know, I know one of our whiskeys, Redbreast, they originally tried it with a 12-year-old. Mm-hmm. So they were making Redbreast Listowel, so which was finished in Oloroso sherry casks from Bodegas Listowel. And they originally tried it with a 12-year-old, but they didn't find it worked quite as well. So they ended up going backwards and using a slightly younger pot still.
Huh.
So it's just a case of when it's ready or when it's the right age. You know, it's not so much this is what we're aiming for.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think a lot of it's probably due to supply and demand. Older whiskey is more expensive for a lot of people. Older whiskey is more desirable. From a pure taste perspective, what's happening there?
So age is something that is important, definitely, but it's not the be-all and end-all of quality in a whiskey. So for a long time, you know, people were told, like, the bigger the number on the bottle, the better the whiskey. And
that would be my impression. I don't know if I get that from wine or I just get that from culture, but...
It's just a decades of that's the way it is. You know, people marketed, you know, for years, like, people always were told, like, buy the older one, it's better. And, I mean, there's a certain element of truth to it in some cases, but, you know, it's more about, you know, the quality of the ingredients, the quality of the casks, the type of casks, and, you know, probably just as important as well, the skill of the blender who puts it together. So while, you know, certainly some of the best whiskies I've had have been older expressions, I've also had a lot of younger expressions and preferred them. Like, one of the ones people always quote to me is, like, we do a 21-year-old Redbreast, which is one of my favorite whiskies of all time. But a lot of times when I do a tasting of the 12 and the 15 and the 21, people sometimes say, well, I really like them all, but I actually still think the 12-year-old is the one I like the most.
Wow.
You know, so I would say to people, if you're out there and you're thinking about buying a whiskey, don't always expect that you're going to like the older one. You know, it's not all about that.
Yeah. What's the oldest whiskey you've ever had?
The oldest whiskey I've had, that's a good question. I think it was I've had some 30-year-old whiskeys before.
My goodness.
And funny enough, this is a perfect point. One of the whiskeys that I tasted, which I'll not name, was a 30-year-old whiskey. And it was, should have been bottled a lot sooner. You know, it's a brand that doesn't exist anymore. But, well, actually, sorry, it does. It's been resurrected. But locally, people will know what it is. But it was a 30-year-old whiskey. And ask anybody who's tasted it and they'll say, yeah, it should have been bottled earlier. What had happened was the distillery was demolished and they'd found this old whiskey and bottled it and started selling it. But it just tastes too much of wood. Like, it's got too much tannin. It's like biting into a tree, you know, it's just all wood. There's no subtlety to it. But at the same time, I've had some older whiskies which are fantastic. Like the 27-year-old Redbreast we've launched is fantastic. The 32-year-old Redbreast, we did that 32 for our dream cask, we called it. It was a once-off bottling and it was a 32-year-old whiskey. And to this day, that's probably in like the top five whiskies I've tasted.
Unbelievable. Talk to me about like our kind of connection, being like from where we are from, between whiskey and coffee, because it's kind of interchangeable for a lot of people and has been for a long time.
Yeah, so the whiskey like revolution, if we want to call it that, like this sudden appetite for, you know, premium spirits, premium whiskeys, premium gins, has coincided with this coffee revolution. You know, and this is something I was talking about with my girlfriend a couple of weeks ago, is it's just interesting to see how much coffee has developed locally in, you know, 10-15 years. You know, I never remembered when I was, you know, younger that there would be coffee shops everywhere. I knew
And he lived on the Yorma Road.
Funny enough, actually, I remember there used to be, I think it was called the Olive Tree or the Olive Garden. It was a deli on the Yorma Road. And I remember being in school and we used to be able to leave at lunchtime at like 16. I remember buying an espresso in there and thought it was really cool. I was like,
hard as nails.
Buying grown up coffee. but yeah, I mean, I think there's this explosion of desire for premium. You know, people aren't really interested as much in, you know, commodity coffee. People want a more premium experience. Mm-hmm. People want something that's brewed by somebody who knows what they're doing. And at the same time, you know, if people are drinking good coffee all week when they're at work, when it gets to the weekend, they're not going to drink bad whiskey. They want to drink good whiskey as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we started to notice, you know, when like I said earlier, when I was in a coffee shop in the Omer Road and I heard somebody talking about coffee, I was just thinking, this is exactly the way that I talk about whiskey.
Yeah.
So from that point, we started to think, well, maybe we should be talking to coffee drinkers. And what we discovered is, like I said, a lot of the people drinking premium coffee also had an interest in premium whiskey. Mm. They're so comparable. I mean, if you think about, you know, how you approach it, you know, how you nose it, how you taste it. Like, I've been to cupping, which is like such a funny word.
So my only context for this conversation was at a coffee cupping where literally someone put a taste wheel in front of me and was like, "This are these are the things you can taste, these are the things you can't taste, blah, blah, blah." And I was like, whoa.
Yeah. And I mean, it's so similar. Like there's the exact same things for whiskey. You can pull up a taste wheel and all these different, you know, aromas and characters you can find. And sometimes you find the same ones in coffee as well. So they're so comparable in that sense, you know. And I think, yeah, like especially over the last couple of years, you know, with the pandemic, I think there's even more of an interest now because people they're going out less, you know. They're starting to think, if I'm going to go out, I'm happy to spend a little bit more and 100%. Get a bit more of a premium experience or a premium product.
Mm-hmm. Totally, mate. Do you want to have a taste of this Irish whiskey here?
Yep. So this, pass me over your whiskey glass there, which we'll not mention is actually just a mug.
Hey, don't dispel the illusion here. This is a high quality show.
There's nothing wrong with drinking whiskey out of a mug. So I know you're really excited to taste this, but before you do, I'll give you a little bit of context about what it is. So this is Par's Gold Label. So this is our kind of main brand or our main whiskey in the Par's family. And it goes away all the way back to 1791, the actual brand itself. So Par's has been about for a very long time. And this is actually, this particular whiskey is probably my most drunk whiskey.
Really?
Yeah, no, and I'm honestly not just saying that because, you know, I work for the brand. Like, people think that I drink Redbreast 21-year-old every weekend, but I don't. Par's Gold Label would be the one I generally go to. So in terms of the actual liquid itself in the bottle, so this is 70% pot still. So pot still is the style of one of the styles of whiskey we make at Middleton. Mm-hmm. What makes it unique is we use malted and unmalted barley together. And that's what gives it this richness, this creaminess.
What does that mean, malted and unmalted?
So barley is the cereal that we actually make the whiskey out of. And before you can make whiskey out of barley, it has to be put through a process called malting, where you just soak it in water, you let it germinate, and then you dry it.
Okay.
And if I was to take that malted barley and make a whiskey out of it, what I'd have is malt whiskey. So that's where the term malt whiskey comes from. But what we're going to do is we're going to make pot still. So we actually combine it with green barley or fresh barley. So barley that hasn't been malted. And that's what gives it its texture. And pot still Irish whiskey is completely unique to Ireland. So no other country in the world makes this style of whiskey.
Crazy.
And it's protected, you know, the same way champagne comes from champagne or cumber potatoes come from cumber. pot still Irish whiskey has to come from Ireland.
Epic.
So we take our pot still and we also have some grain whiskey in here as well. Grain whiskey is just a lighter style of whiskey that we make. We use a different type of still called a column still. And it makes, like I said, a much lighter style. And what we often do, we'll blend our pot still and our grain together. So the likes of Par's Gold Label or Jameson or Middleton Very Rare, they're blended whiskies. So that means in our case, there's pot still and there's grain in there together.
Cool.
Having said that, you can buy single grain whiskey as well. And we have single grain whiskies and they're lovely. But typically what you'll do is, what you'll see in a lot of whiskies is they'll be blended together. So it's two types, you get pot still and grain. And this is aged entirely in American ex-bourbon barrels. So I'm probably going off on a tangent, but
yeah, this is what this show is for.
This is the thing. If you get me started talking about whiskey, like, you'll have to stop me at some stage. So in America, when they make bourbon, there's rules about how you have to make it. Mm-hmm. And one of the rules is bourbon has to be made in a brand new charred white oak barrel.
Right.
So that's the only type.
There are a load of barrels that are just getting.
Yeah, exactly. So think about it this way. These guys, they make their barrels out of white oak, Quercus alba. They char the inside of them. So they put a flame into it and char the inside of the wood. And what that does is it opens up the wood slightly and allows the flavor to come out. So it's done out of necessity. And it doesn't make the whiskey taste burnt. Mm-hmm. It makes it actually taste quite sweet. So it caramelizes the natural sugar. They then fill up their barrels with their spirit, which for bourbon will be mostly made of corn, usually some malted barley, etc. in there as well. And they mature it. After they've done that, they've bottled it. That barrel cannot be used again to make bourbon.
Wow.
So always has to be a brand new barrel. Hence, there's now access to all of these once used barrels from America. And the truth is, you can use a barrel a lot more than one time, you know. And the fact that it's already been used once, in our case, is quite a good thing, because the first time you use that barrel, you're going to get a lot of sweetness. Mm-hmm. So that's why typically bourbon tends to be quite sweet. Mm-hmm. So when it arrives in Ireland, we won't get quite as much sweetness out of it. So we tend to use the barrels in Middleton three times. So you'll have a B1, B2, B3, and that's first fill, second fill, third fill.
Yeah, yeah.
So this one is all American oak, and it's mostly refill barrels. So what we really want to highlight for Pars is the distillate style. So whenever you taste this, you'll notice you'll get that lovely American oak character. You'll get the, you know, the honey, the caramel, the vanilla, but you should also taste the spirit. You should taste some of that kind of orchard fruit coming through and a lot of spice as well. So I'm aware that I've just been talking at you about the technicality of whiskey. I'm sure you want to taste
all,
it.
All you've done is just make my mouth water.
So what I would say, first of all, is
to smell.
Have a smell, to nose it. So nosing is just a fancy word for smelling. So just leave your mouth open and just kind of breathe in through your nose. And I'll try not to put any words in your mouth. So I always like to ask people what they think. And there's no wrong answers.
Why do you keep your mouth open?
It just, I find in my experience, it tends to help me get more aroma.
Actually, I found it really hard to smell with my mouth open. Well, I've just been sitting there last 10 seconds, like, keep your mouth open,
okay.
Keep your
mouth open. Don't think about it too much.
Yeah, no, it smells. It smells a lot sweeter than I was expecting it to smell.
Yeah, there is a sweetness definitely on this, like all American ex-bourbon barrels. So there will be a kind of honey character coming through. I always find this one, I get a little bit of cereal on the nose as well. But yeah, sweet cereal, a little bit of kind of pepper maybe coming through. You'll probably get more of that on the palate.
Pepper?
Yeah, well, like a peppery, spicy sort of note.
Oh, yeah.
So Pars is described as a spicy style of whiskey. And whenever you say spicy to somebody who's never had Pars before, they're like, "Don't you know, what is it?
Am I drinking hot sauce?"
Yeah, exactly. But really what we mean, we call it pot still spice. So it's kind of like a peppery note. I tend to get it just kind of at the front of your palate. But have a wee taste, have a wee sip. Let it sit on your palate if you want for a few seconds. I like to kind of chew it a little bit and then just enjoy it.
I know the witness is being led right now, but genuinely get some notes of caramel in there.
Yeah. I mean, it's an easy whiskey to kind of get those notes from. You know, like it does have that honey and caramel vanilla. I would say it's a whiskey that kind of smells and tastes the same way. Like sometimes they don't, but for Pars, like whenever I get that on the nose, I get this lovely honey character.
Mm-hmm.
I immediately want to drink it, and then I get some of that honey and that caramel and that vanilla as well on the taste.
I would say, like, in terms of like the full, like, sensation on the tongue and then even on the throat, it reminds me of that, like, very satisfied feeling. You know, whenever you, like, go out for dinner, you've got, like, and you really treat yourself, you get three courses, and you're, like, too full for dessert, and then you have dessert. That, like, really satisfied feeling you have after that dessert, that's kind of what it reminds me of.
Yeah, like, just, like, a nice sweet finish to
it. Yeah, like, really satisfied, like, that was really good.
That's what I get every time I drink this whiskey. But yeah, no, I mean, it's a whiskey. I would describe it as a whiskey drinker's whiskey. So it's quite an intense flavor. You know, if you compare it to a lighter style of whiskey, like a lighter blend, Pars would be more of that kind of powerful, spicy, distillate style.
Yet it is quite easy to drink.
Yeah.
Like straight up here.
It's one that I always have an open bottle of in the house.
Yeah.
And it's one that I always like to introduce people to. Most of the time when people try it, they're like pleasantly surprised because they either haven't had it before or they just think of it as, oh yeah, I remember like my granddad used to drink that.
Yeah.
And then they taste it and they go, oh, this is actually really lovely. It's one that like, it's very underrated, I think, you know, and a lot of people are starting to rediscover Pars. So, you know, for a long time, Jameson would have been what we were shouting about a lot.
Yeah.
And rightly so, you know, and it's as a result, Jameson is in every bar in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But now that we have a bit more time, we're actually starting to relook at some of the older brands and revisit Pars. So that's why it's got this new branding. So it got a bit of a makeover there a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
New bottle, new label. And we're starting to actually talk about it a bit more and introduce people to it. And almost all the time, people are like, wow, that's actually a really lovely whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's one that I'm always really excited to talk about.
Yeah, that is so nice. It's the first time I've had whiskey on the podcast. You'll probably be glad to hear.
not the last, I'm sure. So, I mean, it's a whiskey that I drink neat, you know, and when it comes to people sometimes ask, like, what's the right way to drink whiskey? Is there a right way to do it? And honestly, the right way is just however you enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are no rules. So like I hate this idea of like snobbery and whiskey, and you can't have it with ice, you can't have it with water, you can't mix it.
Yeah.
That's all rubbish in my opinion. So, I mean, certainly I would say if you're talking about a very old or very expensive whiskey, probably don't want to be mixing it with Coke or something. But the likes of this, you know, there's so many ways to drink it. I drink it neat, but it also works really well in cocktails, like spirit forward drinks, like an old fashioned.
So actually one of my like things I had to cover with this conversation while I had you here was, my recent drink that I've really got into is old fashioned. Like I started making old fashions at home.
Yeah.
So do you have any advice for an extreme novice old fashioned maker to take it to the next level?
To take it to the next level? There's so much you can do with an old fashioned. So the name itself, old fashioned, is because this is one of the original cocktails. So originally a cocktail would have been a spirit, some kind of sugar, bitters, and ice.
Mm.
That was it. So what happened was people were starting to introduce new ingredients and cocktails were getting a bit more complex. And a lot of people said, no, I don't want that. I want it the old fashioned way. So that's kind of where this drink came from.
Awesome.
Ways you can really take to the next level. I always like to play around with the type of sugar. So in the house, you know, some people would just use white sugar or brown sugar.
So I tell you, my process at the minute, and then you can level it up. Okay. So I use sugar cubes, white sugar cubes, crush it up, put the bitters in. Put the ice in, put the whiskey in, swirl it around, a wee slice of orange, squeeze it in, drop it in, and that's me good to go.
That would be like the OG, so you're making it the real
tradition. The old-fashioned.
Yeah, I mean that was the way people would do it, was like put the bitters in the sugar cube and then
that's
muddle
right.
it. And,
yeah, that's what it is.
And that's perfectly good way. That was the way I originally used to make my old-fashions. And keep in mind, like, I'm going to recommend some other ways, but the way you're doing it is totally
no,
fine.
No, I'm an open guy. I'm interested in other ways.
I like maple syrup sometimes instead of the sugar. Yeah, so sugar is, it's great, but I always think there's a bit more work involved because you have to get it all dissolved.
I find it hard to get it all dissolved. And then it's actually at the end, and it's like at the end of like Cocoa Pops. You've got this really sugary bit and you're like,
It's the dessert at the end of your meal.
Yeah.
What you can do is you can make your own syrup really easily. So make your own sugar syrup. It's literally one part sugar, one part water, kind of low heat on the hob, and then just pour it into a bottle, keep it in the fridge. You can do it with brown sugar. You can do it with Demerara sugar. You can use Muscovado.
Brown
so
sugar,
lots of different sugars.
Of
will and also your bitters as well. So, you know, Angostura would be what most people would use. But
house,
you can use like a dash of Angostura and a dash of orange bitters, or you can explore lots of different types of bitters. Like you can get chocolate bitters or grapefruit bitters, and that will ultimately change the flavor. If you want to really take it to the next level, you got to start making your own ice. There's something so satisfying about a perfectly clear ice cube in your drink, you know, and people underestimate the importance of ice in a cocktail. Like it is one of the main ingredients, you know, so you don't want to be throwing in like some broken up ice from the bottom of your freezer.
This is where there's serious room for improvement, because I think the last batch of old fashions I made, they were with like store bought ice, you know, from a
the store bought stuff. Like there's a Arctic Ice, I think, is the local company that I usually buy, and it's good quality ice. What I would say is also make sure you put enough ice in. If you only just put in a cube or two, you'll find that it'll just dilute your drink. The more ice you put in, it'll keep it cooler and won't dilute as much.
So it was during the heat wave, and I loaded that baby up like it was so icy.
I was
spending
a fortune on ice.
So how do you make clear ice?
Well, first of all, it's not something that I do because I don't have a big enough freezer to do it. But I do know some people that do it, and the way they do it is they get like a cooler, you know, that you would take on a picnic, and you fill that up with water, and then you put that in a chest freezer.
Oh my goodness, what?
There's a bit of work in it. And then you take it away and you chip away a bit of the ice at the bottom, which I think will have like some of the impurities on it. And what you're left with is the clear ice. This is something that, you know, really high-end cocktail bars will really pride themselves on is the quality of their ice.
Right.
I'm trying to convince my girlfriend to let me buy a chest freezer upstairs, but just having a freezer
we
solely for ice.
We need to think of the clear ice.
Yeah, just think of all the cocktails I would make her. It's a good way to take your drink to the next level. And, you know, just like, obviously the taste is the most important thing, but you want a drink that looks nice as well.
The
first thing you do when you see a cocktail is you taste it with your eyes. You know, that looks that looks good. So good quality ice goes a long way.
So what's your opinion on are that whiskey rocks versus
the stones?
Ice? Stones, yeah.
To be honest, I think if you want to drink your whiskey cold and you don't want it diluted, just put your whiskey in the fridge. You know? Save yourself a few quid.
That's genius.
Yeah, it's that's the idea, is people don't want it to dilute the whiskey. I've found that in my experience, you could blow on your whiskey and get it to be cooler. Like, they don't really seem to work. Maybe I didn't have them cold enough. But yeah, I think the easy solution is just put your whiskey in the fridge.
Nice one. Enjoy that. So talk to us about hot whiskey then, this Irish coffee.
So yeah, I mean, the Irish coffee is probably one of the best known drinks from Ireland. You know, it's the sort of thing you can go into any bar in the world. And,
literally.
Yeah, and they'll at least know what an Irish coffee is. They might not necessarily make it the best way, but they'll know what it is. But yeah, so the Irish coffee, this is it dates back to the 1940s, actually. So the origins of this drink were in Shannon Airport, or what was Shannon Airport. There was a flight of people going to America from the airport. And what had happened was the plane had to turn around after being in the air for, I think, maybe like 20 minutes or half an hour, and reroute back to Ireland because of the weather.
Ugh.
And this was before, you know, those big tubes that would go straight to your plane. So that's the plane right. landed right in the runway. People would get off and have to walk back to the airport and probably got a bit soaked in the process. So the pilot had said to the head chef in the airport, which was a guy called Joe Sheridan, can you make up some kind of drink or something, kind of food, to, you know, cheer these people up a bit? So what he did was he took whiskey, sugar, coffee and cream Epic. And combined them in this specific way and gave it to all the passengers. And they loved it. And as the story goes, people said, oh, where's this coffee from? Is this Colombian coffee? Or, and they said, no, it's Irish coffee. There's whiskey in it. So that's kind of where it came from. It was served in the airport for a few years and never really took off. But what happened then was a guy called Stanton Denaplane, what a name.
Wow, amazing.
But he was a travel writer, and he tried the drink in the airport and then fell in love with it.
Wow.
Went back to America and tried to recreate it. And I think he tried for a good year or two and couldn't quite get it right. I think it was to do with the dairy being different in Ireland than it is in America. But eventually he realized by lightly whipping the cream, he could get it to float on top. And the drink was introduced to the Buena Vista Cafe in San Francisco and just exploded in popularity.
Unbelievable.
And still to this day, like, they claim to sell between 2,000 and 3,000 Irish coffees in a day. There's great videos of guys in this cafe, like, just making, you know, 10 of these at once. Really impressive.
Wow. Because it's a tough thing to get right.
Well, it is and it isn't. Like, a lot of people are intimidated by this. You know, they think it looks really difficult to make, or, you know, but the truth is, once you've made it once, it's pretty easy. The secret is just using the right ingredients and doing it in the right order. And it's one of those drinks as well. We always laugh, like, if you see somebody in a bar walking past you with an Irish coffee, suddenly you're like, oh, that looks nice. I want one of those. So I would say to people, like, at home, don't be afraid to make it. Like, it's super easy. And, you know, that's what we're kind of here to talk about is try making it and show us what you're making. And, you know, try something new. Can you take it to the next level? Can you do something a bit different?
So walk us through how to make this.
So this is a classic Pars Irish coffee. So the traditional ingredients for this are Pars Irish whiskey, coffee, cream and sugar. So the way that I would make it is, first of all, I would get the right type of glass. So what you want is, you know, a small enough glass. Like, there is a standard kind of Irish coffee glass. If you don't have one of those, you can use a small wine glass. But basically what you want to do, first of all, is heat it if you can. So get some hot water, put it into the glass just to get the glass nice and warmed up. After that, what you want to do is empty it out, add in your whiskey. So add in 35 mils of Pars whiskey. Then you want to put in your sugar. So
how do you eyeball 35, by the way?
I've just done it a lot of times. I would recommend using a measure, definitely in the house. That's one people underestimate. Like, do use a measure, because you'd be surprised what 35 mils actually looks like. You can either go way under or way over. Suddenly you're having a very strong Irish coffee. But put in 35 mils. Then add your sugar. So how sweet you want it just kind of depends on your own tastes. I would say roughly about a teaspoon and a half is a good kind of standard. You can use white sugar, you can use brown sugar, you can use sugar syrup, you can use honey, you can use maple syrup. Like, this is one of the things that can make it a bit easier.
Oh, funny, interesting,
But I've just used obviously regular white sugar. So your whiskey, then your sugar, and then what you want to do is top it up with freshly brewed coffee. And obviously we want good quality coffee, so that's what we've done today. We've got some coffee from the guys next door.
Shout out to Napoleon, honestly, guys, thank you so much.
And they were able to sit and say, oh, actually I think this type of coffee would work with it.
We're drinking a Brazilian today.
But this is what we're really talking about is, you know, it's not about using cheap instant coffee anymore. It's about using really good quality premium freshly brewed coffee. So top up your glass. You want to leave roughly about a centimeter or so at the top.
Okay.
And then you're going to put your cream on it. Now, what you want to do with your cream is get it lightly whipped. So if you have a bottle, just pour a bit out so there's a bit of air in there and just give it a good shake. If you have, what I did today was put it into a cocktail shaker.
That's what you were doing there. That makes sense.
Yep. So basically what I've done is I've got a cocktail shaker, got the cream in there, given it a wee bit of a shake. You just want it lightly whipped, so you don't want it to be too thick. Once it's lightly whipped, what you want to do then is just pour it over the back of a spoon to float it on top of the drink.
Nice.
So if we're looking at our Irish coffee here, you get this lovely creamy white head, and that's what the way it should be.
Yeah.
So what you don't want to do is mix it, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes you see people like pour the cream on and then mix it all together.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it'll still be nice.
It's but a cardinal sin though.
it's not the way I would recommend enjoying it, because whenever you sip this, what you want to do is sip through the cream. So you're going to get this lovely kind of creamy texture first of all, and then you're going to get the whiskey and the coffee and the sugar all coming at you.
Epic. Right, let's go. Also, is it just a coincidence that Irish coffees look like a glass of Guinness?
It is a bit of a, you know, funny when I was looking out there and thinking, yeah, it does actually have that lovely creaminess on top.
Oh man. It is, it's the barrier of cream that makes it so exciting.
Yeah.
Because it just hits you a wee bit later. And that's such a pleasant sensation, isn't it?
It's the contrast of the temperature, I think, which is actually quite nice as well. So you get this lovely, like, you know, not cold, not warm, but, you know, nice soft temperature. Then suddenly the lovely warm coffee coming in afterwards. So,
do you know what? Actually, it's the perfect amount of sugar in that as well.
Is that not too sweet or anything?
That's perfect.
Good. Really, that's how I would normally make it in the house, you know, about a teaspoon and a half.
So good. You mentioned the temperature there. When you were talking earlier about twisting it up, any success with like an iced Irish coffee?
Yeah, it's something that we've looked at, you know, a couple of times in the past, and we've done some stuff with bartenders. Yeah, like I love iced coffee. I love, you know, cold brew. So one of the ways I actually I drank Powers a few years ago was I made some cold brew coffee and had a measure of Powers in it, topped up with cold brew, a little bit of tonic water, and then a squeeze of lime. So probably not the kind of creamy sort of cold drink, you know, people might be expecting, but it worked really well. It was really nice. But yeah, even like if you get something like an iced latte and just put some Powers in it,
it's epic.
It's like spiking a milkshake, you know. It tastes good.
This is probably very lowbrow whiskey consuming, but a few Christmases ago, maybe I think it was two Christmases ago, we just really got into whiskey and hot chocolate.
Yeah.
Like it just was so satisfying because it was like the double warmth and it just hits you and you're like, I feel cozy. This is epic.
It's funny. we were chatting, just myself and my girlfriend, about how the weather seems to be changing a bit now. You know, we're not at the end of summer yet, but certainly the days are a wee bit shorter. And she was like, oh, I know, I'm really enjoying summer. And I'm like, I can't wait till it gets nice and cold and you can drink cozy Irish coffees and hot chocolates and just, you know.
100%, mate.
Yeah.
Jaggy nettle, get the fire going. It's just epic.
It's a good spot, yeah.
So, so good.
It's actually just around the corner from my house too. So like I've got the Jaggy and the Arable, two nice kind of cozy pubs on either side of me.
Incredible, mate. Incredible. Oh, man. Well, look, thank you. That was such a treat. Really enjoyed tasting those things. And even more exciting is to kind of have that bit of education is a weird word, but the education around it as well. Because it makes you more aware, you know. You were talking earlier about you were into photography. I remember talking to a mate, I think it was a couple of days ago, we were saying how, like, whenever you travel, like, having a camera with you makes you appreciate your experience so much more because it forces you to focus on your environment a little bit more than if you were just kind of walking laissez-faire. And I think like whenever you add even a story to like the food or drink that you're about to have, it makes you kind of a bit more appreciative and helps you taste it a bit more.
And that's what people want though as well. You know, if people are going into a bar most of the time and they're wanting to buy a whiskey or they're wanting to buy a gin or whatever it might be, they're not just going to pick anything. They're going to want something. They're going to want the bartender or the barista to talk them through it, to tell them a wee bit about it, you know, why it tastes this way. And I think even, you know, whether it's whiskey or coffee or food, as you said earlier, like if you're listening to somebody talk about something and they're passionate about it, that's going to inspire you to be a wee bit passionate as well. Because you suddenly see that we've got an Irish coffee incident.
I've just spilled the rest of my Irish coffee all over my beautiful notebook.
Well, at least you got to drink the first half of it anyway.
Do you know what? I did. And I got most of the cream, so we're very happy about that.
Do you know what? These things happen, you know.
And the plus side is that book, because this, it's a leather kind of shell that you put over these books. So for the rest of time, this leather will smell like Powers whiskey.
Whiskey and coffee, certainly, yeah.
Well, look, landing the plane, there's a few stock questions that we kind of end every episode with. First two are a bit kind of big picture and are a bit heavier, but what has been the most challenging moment for you so far, and how have you been able to overcome it?
In terms of just life, or
In terms of just life.
Wow, that is a difficult question. I suppose, honestly, just like what we talked about earlier, like trying to figure out what you want to do. You know, like I think when you're at school and you're at that age, like 15, 16, 17, that's still very young. And, you know, that's a lot of pressure to suddenly decide what path you're going to go down. And I mean, I didn't ever make that decision. It kind of naturally happened for me. So I suppose that, you know, trying to decide what direction you want your life to go in. I also think, you know, and I mean, this is probably going to sound cliche and you've probably heard this a lot, but like the last couple of years have been challenging, certainly for everybody. But I mean, I think just in terms of not being able to see friends and family, like that was a big hit. Like, you know, I'd be very close to my family. We're very closely knit, you know, with my sisters and my parents and my brother, and not being able to see them the way that I'm used to, you know, like it was great to be able to talk to them on the phone, but there's something about going over to somebody's house and, you know, sitting.
So different.
It is. And like, whenever we relaxed restrictions, I thought, I wonder, will it be weird, you know, getting back into the swing of things? But within 2 minutes of anybody that I was close with, you're just back into the rhythm again.
100%. And like, you know, we were talking kind of off mic how, you know, you've done a good bit of traveling, you've lived overseas and stuff. Like, I think like with the people, it's a true mark of like a relationship whenever you can have time apart and you come back and it's just exactly the way it was.
Yeah.
You know, because that's life. And the relationships that I have kind of like drifted away from are the ones that haven't had that coming back togetherness, you know?
Yeah. It's that instant feeling of familiarity. You know, it's suddenly you sit down with somebody and you're like, I haven't seen this person in a year or two years or 3 years. And within a couple of minutes, you're just back into the exact same flow again.
100%, mate. 100%. Most successful moment so far?
Okay, that's another hard one. I mean, this is kind of a nerdy technical one for me, but I did, Dylan Bass were kind enough to put me through something called the GCD, which is the General Certificate in Distillation.
Unreal.
So it's a course that you can do to kind of introduce you to actual brewing and distilling, which is something I'm obviously, you know, really interested in because it's kind of what I do for a living. Like, I don't make the whiskey, but I wanted to know more about it and be able to talk about it with more confidence. So I went through the GCD, which is, for me, it was really challenging. I found it really difficult. I wouldn't have been the best at science in school. And brewing and distilling is science, you know. Wow. It's most it is science. So being able to do that, and you know, I did fail it the first time round. It's a multiple choice question, and they don't tell you what you got right or what you got wrong.
Brutal.
Which made it so much more difficult. But I failed. But then resat it and did it again for the second time, and was so delighted. Like, I remember how happy I was when I got that phone call. Because I had it, you know, and I was like, I finally achieved this, but also because I was like, I don't have to do it again.
Yeah.
This is so difficult.
Yeah.
So that was a big achievement. And I think like that was a few years ago, and I would have left school a long time, and you'd be surprised how you can forget how to learn.
Yeah. You forget the game of exams as well.
Yeah. Like totally. Having to study, you know, it took me a few weeks to figure out like how to get into that rhythm of studying. So glad I did that, you know, glad I've got it under my belt. Certainly I found that was a bit challenging.
Well, that's it. And you will like literally have that, like that'll carry with you for the rest of your career, you know?
Yeah.
It's exciting.
One under the belt.
I have to tweak this next one slightly. If you could take anyone from Northern... Okay, yeah, no, I've got it. If you could take anyone from Northern Ireland out for a glass of whiskey, sounds excessive, but you understand what I mean. From Northern Ireland, dead or alive, who would you take? Where would you take them? And then this is the big one. What whiskey would you serve them?
So anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, where would take them? What I would serve them? That is a good question. There are a lot of great people from Northern Ireland to choose from. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think, would it be more interesting to pick somebody who isn't alive? Probably Seamus Heaney.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a big fan of poetry, and like I think Seamus Heaney is a great ambassador for us here.
Seamus Heaney is also a great like describing word.
Seamus Heaney.
Oh, yes, there's so much Seamus Heaney going on there.
I haven't even had any whiskeys today. I would probably say Seamus Heaney, and I would take him to, like, one of my favorite places to go for a drink is the Oak in the Airgill, which is, I don't know if you've been into that section of it, but there's a wee quiet bar in the back called the Oak Lounge. And it feels like it hasn't changed maybe in like 30 or 40 years at least. It's really, you know, just short chairs, short tables, it's table service, really lovely atmosphere in there, no music, no TVs. And I'd probably just have a glass of Pars because it's what I love the most, you know, in terms of, Pars is the whiskey that I drink in the bar. You know, if I'm going to the bar and I just want to sit and have a whiskey, like what we did earlier, we sat and tasted it and talked about it and nosed it. And that's great. And there's a time and place for that. But sometimes you just want to sit and have a whiskey and enjoy it. And Pars is the whiskey that I would just like to sit and sip on. So it's probably one I would choose. And considering how old it is, I'd say he'd probably be familiar with it as well. He'd probably have drank Pars at some stage.
That's awesome. Yeah, one of the things I try to do before, like literally like the 5 minutes before I sit down with somebody is I just, if they have Twitter, flick through their Twitter. And you had retweeted a photo of Seamus Heaney and his like class that he was teaching.
Yeah, it was a picture in Dublin, I think, wasn't
it?
Yeah,
and that was, I've never seen that side of Seamus. He was so joyful looking and just like all the kids were beaming. I didn't even know he was a teacher. I was like, whoa, amazing.
It's funny. One of the questions I know you'd asked beforehand was to pick your favorite quote.
Yeah.
And I was looking at like Seamus Heaney quotes and James Joyce quotes. And I was like, there's nothing here that's like too happy. Some of these are quite dark. But absolutely. Like to see a photo of him smiling like that.
So full of joy.
But there's so many great accounts. And that's one of the things I think Twitter is great for. There's so many history accounts. Like there's like history of Belfast and history of Dublin. And my mum, she follows me on Twitter and she always retweets like these old photos. So that's how I end up seeing them quite often. It's nice to look back.
It's awesome. Just because we brought it up, you know, one of the things you did submit was your favorite quote. Your body's not a temple. It's an amusement park. Enjoy the ride. Why does that speak to you?
Well, I actually, rather than picking a quote, I actually just wanted to pick somebody that I admired, you know, and find something.
Because he also was on your Twitter timeline, Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah, I'd be a big fan of Anthony Bourdain. Like so many people now, I feel like, you know, he's over the last few years, there's been a resurgence, certainly since his death anyway, which was obviously tragic. I was always a fan of his.
Who is he for people who aren't familiar?
So Anthony Bourdain, he is a former chef who then became an author and wrote several books. Kitchen Confidential would be the one most people are familiar with. But it was a kind of look into what life is actually like working as a chef. And it's a bit, it's a bit of a rock and roll sort of book, if you want to call it that. He had great success with that book and then went on to work for a few different TV companies and made a lot of great television, traveling around, you know, introducing people to food. So traveling all over the world. And trying different foods. You know, he never cooked, I don't think, in the programs. It was all about just trying other people's food. But just a great personality. Loved reading his books. I've read a few of them now. Loved watching him on TV. But I think he obviously inspired a lot of people to, you know, not take food too seriously, to just enjoy it and appreciate it and to be a bit more adventurous, you know, when eating. And certainly, like, you know, whether it's whiskey or wine or food or whatever it is, like I would always say people, like, even if you don't like something, try it, you know, and if you don't like it the first time, try it again. You know, the majority of things that I like now, I did not like when I was younger, you know, and I'll admit it, whiskey was one of them. Like you know, I didn't like whiskey the first time
I
tasted
olives.
It. Yeah, olives. Like the best foods and drinks, like whiskey, olives, coffee, cheese, beer. Yeah. Like who tries those and immediately likes them?
100%.
Your palate develops and you get a taste for them. And I was a really fussy eater as a kid, so it surprises me now that I like olives. But
that's great.
I do love them. But yeah, I know I always say to people, like, be adventurous and try something, you know, and if you don't like it, try it again in a year.
Totally, mate. We just have I was going to say newborn, it's not accurate, she just turned one. And so we're like, you know, my head's full of like all this baby facts and knowledge that I didn't have like a year ago. And one of the things you see quite a lot is like, apparently, like kids, they need to try something 7 times before they actually know if they like it or not.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that probably sounds about right.
Yeah,
I mean, I think like as a kid, I don't know what you were like as a kid, but I think most kids are fussy eaters to an extent.
But also I think like most Northern Irish families of our demographic, like around our age group, like just didn't try a lot of things. Like you had like a particular wheelhouse of meals that were just like, this is what we eat. So to, you know, to venture outside of that, like even pickles are like, you know,
I think the first time I had an avocado, I was like 21 or something.
Yeah, but Jack's out.
but then you think about it, like, you couldn't have got a lot of these things.
Yeah, well, my granny always talks about how she remembers, like, pasta coming to Northern Ireland. You know, these things are, like, they're relatively new in our cuisine.
But, like, this is the great thing about, you know, Belfast and Northern Ireland now is suddenly we have, like, this explosion of variety and food, you know.
So true.
I remember coming back from, like, holidays in places like, you know, New York or Los Angeles, and you'd have tried pho or sushi or something. And you're like, oh, I really like this. And you get back and you're like, okay, well, I'm not going to be trying that again anytime soon. But now you can get these things here.
Yeah, literally.
It's just great to be able to have a bit of variety in your life.
Where is the best margarita you've ever had?
I make a pretty good margarita.
Oh, yeah?
I have to say, yeah. I do make a good margarita. You know, best one I've had or best one, I think... You know what, I always remember the drinks, the quality of the drinks, not so much just the drink itself, but like the experience, you know. So, I mean, most recently, I would say the best margarita I had was I had somebody over to my house for food. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time that we could have done this, you know, because of COVID restrictions. So it was one of my close friends and my girlfriend. We had tacos and we had margaritas. And I remember particularly enjoying that margarita. Mm. I don't know if it was just because it was done really well or if it was because of the company I was with.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, generally, like, whether it's, you know, the best cocktail you've had or the best whiskey, it's more about the people and the place, you know, and the experience than the actual drink itself.
There's a Hebrew proverb I love, and it says something along the lines of, a bowl of vegetables with someone you love is better than a steak with someone you hate.
Yeah, I like that.
And I really enjoy that.
Yeah. No, and it's absolutely true, you know. You could be sitting eating a really boring sandwich with somebody you like, or you could be eating in a 5-star restaurant with somebody you're less fond of. Totally, and you're going to enjoy that sandwich a bit more, I'd say.
Totally. Final question then, one we always end with. If you could go back to an 18-year-old Joe, what would you say to that younger version of yourself if you had a few minutes of his time?
Hear the deep questions today.
Like, you save them for the end, you know, before people can run away.
I should have poured myself a whiskey for this one. Do you know what? I don't know if I would say anything, because I think the way your life works out, you become a certain person for that reason, you know. And I you know, it would be great to go back and say, do things differently. But, you know, then I wouldn't be the same person that I am now, you know. Like, I might have gone in a different direction. And I like, you know, the life that I have now, you know. Totally. I like my job. I like the people are close to me, so I wouldn't want to change that. So I wouldn't necessarily, you know, try and steer myself in any direction. I would probably say, you know, don't panic and think that you have to have everything worked out, because the older I've got, I've realized that, you know, there's people 10, 20, 30 years older than me who still haven't got it all figured out, and that's fine.
Totally, mate. Joe, like, before you go, there is a competition that you would like to share with us. So, mate, the floor is yours. Let us know what the crack is and how we can be involved.
Yeah, so basically, we're running a competition. We know the classic pairing of coffee and whiskey is hard to beat. And tradition is obviously really important in whiskey. You know, authenticity is important, tradition is important. But we've been starting to wonder, can you improve on perfection? So we're looking for a fresh take or a new twist on a Powers Irish coffee. So obviously, traditionally, you've got your Powers whiskey, your sugar, your coffee and your cream. And what we're asking people to do is to share their own take on that. So we want to know what people would add, what they might swap, what they might change, what they might tweak. The competition's open to the members of the public, but we're also opening to bartenders and baristas. So we're challenging the public, bartenders and baristas to share their recipes for their Irish coffee. So to enter, you just need to share a photo or a video of your perfect Powers Irish coffee. Make sure you tag us, Powers Whiskey NI, on Instagram and Twitter, and use the hashtag Powers Irish Coffee. And you can do that right up until the 30th of September. If you're looking at any more info, you can find it all on our social feed. So literally just search for us, Powers Whiskey NI. And there's some great prizes up for grabs, including over £500 worth of really lovely artisan food and goodies.
Awesome, mate. And if you send that to me, I'm happy to put that on the webpage as well.
Perfect.
And people can click through the link and read everything from there. I suppose as well, just before we wrap up then, it would be important to close this loop. You mentioned earlier that you're 30. What has been one of the most significant tastes and smells of the last year for you?
Of the last year? Good question. Let me have a think. Do you know, actually, within the last year, obviously we haven't been able to go on holiday recently, so we haven't been able to go out and have these nice experiences or go on holiday. So at the end of last year, it was kind of around Christmas, my girlfriend and I got really into cheese. We started spending loads of money on cheese.
Epic.
We're just like, yeah, if we're not going to go out the weekend, let's just buy like a 20, 25 pound cheese board. And we would sit and we would have cheese and we'd have olives and we'd have some cured meats and I'd have a glass of sherry as well.
Nice.
And just all of those together was like the perfect package because that's exactly what we loved eating in Spain.
Yeah.
And I remember as soon as I tasted it, you know, had the combination together, I'm like, you know, it's not quite as good as being on holiday, but
it's
about as close as it can get, you know. So I'd say that would probably be the...
Awesome, mate. It's sensory overload. It's one of the best things in life.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what we were talking about earlier, like... A taste can take you immediately back to an experience, you know, and your olfactory sense is really closely linked to the part of your brain, the hippocampus, which processes memory. So there is an actual reason why when you smell something, you know, it can immediately invoke a really strong reaction. Mm. And I think, you know, whiskey and coffee and food do that really well.
Awesome. Mate, I'm glad we came back for that wee bit.
My pleasure. No, good crack chatting with you.
Awesome, mate.